I'm pleased to be joined by two men who have both written and thought a lot about that time in those days. John Meacham, the journalist, and James Bradley, the author. Gentlemen, please join us. John Meacham is a journalist, historian, and author, of course, of the splendid biography of President Bush, Destiny and Power. And James Bradley, the man who wrote two best-selling accounts of the war in the Pacific, Flags of Our Fathers and later Flyboys, of course, tells the story of the very air raid in which President Bush was shot down. Gentlemen, welcome, and let me just start by with you, James, just by asking you for your thoughts and reflections on this day.
Pearl Harbor, David Jones outside said that there were 27 veterans, World War II veterans here. And so there were 27 different Pearl Harbor experiences, right, in the room. There were millions of Pearl Harbor experiences. And I'd like to talk to the students here. Just imagine that tomorrow something happens that you have to think about. Imagine you're George Bush at your prep school, you're 17 years old. He was a big man on campus. He was president of a number of societies. He was president of his class. He was captain of the baseball team. He had his future mapped out. He was already accepted at Yale, where his father had graduated. He had a beautiful golden future all lined up. And the moment that he's walking across the campus on his feet, he decides, I'm going to do something about this. I'm going to go into naval aviation. And he abandons that life. I think that's important to consider his thinking at that point. At the graduation ceremony, Secretary of War Stimson spoke. And Secretary Stimson is speaking to these highly educated guys. And he says, you know, we don't need all of you to enlist in the military. We need some of your brains in Washington. It was an appeal from the Secretary of War to not enlist, to help out in another way. George Bush's father, Prescott, spoke to him after the ceremony and said, George, did you hear anything from the Secretary that might change your mind? George Bush looked at his father and said, no, sir, I'm going in. 2 months later, his father said goodbye to him at Penn Station. And George Bush said, that's the first time I saw my father cry.
John?
It was a day that changed individual lives. Senator Dole talked about hearing it at the Kappa Sigma House, where, as he pointed out last night, he spent most of his time in college, which is a good sign for those of us who did that down the decades. So it changed individual lives, but it also changed the country and the world. We had been living for 12 years or so with a predominantly isolationist sentiment. We had retreated from the world. In 1933, the first 3 months of 1933, Adolf Hitler had come to power. Franklin Roosevelt had begun his four terms as president. On September 1st, 1939, Hitler had invaded Poland. Japan was on the march in the Pacific. And yet an extraordinary number of Americans at home believed that the lesson of the First World War was that European entanglements led to bloodshed and depression. Because the Great Depression in the United States, which affected so many million Americans, 25% of working men were out of work. Senator Dole's family had to rent out the top of their house, and they moved into the basement to make ends meet. The depression in the popular political mind was associated with warfare. And so even after the war began in Europe in 39 and 40, you had Winston Churchill desperately seeking the help and aid of the United States. And it was very slow to come forth. One of the great speeches ever delivered in the history of oratory was on the 4th of June, 1940, by Winston Churchill, who said, after the miracle at Dunkirk, that we shall fight in the beaches, we shall fight in the streets, we shall fight with growing strength and growing confidence in the air. We shall never surrender. And even if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world in all its power and might will step forth to the rescue and liberation of the old.
It was, of course, a moment that he had waited for, not knowing what shape it would take. But think about it, James. I mean, here was Winston Churchill, who had a little to show for the first 2 years of that war, but defeat, retreat, and evacuation. And then this. Your thoughts?
Well, David Niven, the actor, was with Winston Churchill when he found out at Checkers that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. And Churchill took out his cigar and said, "Now we will win. We have the partner that he had been looking for."
It's a little more complicated. With due respect to the possibly the largest human being of our time, Winston Churchill, as Isaiah Berlin called him, when he finished that speech about the new world stepping forward, that was a prayer and a plea that Franklin Roosevelt and the United States, that men like Bush and Dole and the other men here, and the women who made it possible for them to go, the farmers who grew the crops, the people who built the armaments, were top of mind for Churchill. And Churchill stood across the channel and he said, "Hitler has gone that far, but he'll go no farther." But remember what happened on this day 75 years ago. Hitler did not bomb Pearl Harbor. Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. Franklin Roosevelt did not mention Germany on Sunday, December 7th or Monday, December 8th. He waited for Hitler to declare war on us. I think that this day is a hinge of history. It extended for a week, and I think in many ways what it affirms is an essential goodness in the American soul that, again, to quote Churchill, you can always count on us to do the right thing, usually after we've exhausted every other possibility.
Yeah. It's probably, one reads the history of those times, recognizing, as you do, that Franklin Roosevelt was as fully aware as Churchill was that Hitler had to be stopped and the United States was going to have to be a big part of it. But he was politically not in a position to make this happen until after Pearl Harbor. So it's worth reflecting, perhaps, James, on this day, on the strength of the anti-war forces in the United States and the sentiment of that at that time.
Well, huge. There were college students were taking the Oxford Oath that I will not support my country in any war. Anti-war sentiment was huge. When Roosevelt met with Churchill in August of 1941, he said to Churchill that, you know, "I'd like to help, but I can't get a head of the electorate." His hands were tied. So Pearl Harbor just changed the world. It changed the mind of George Bush and Bob Dole and millions of people across the country, and gave Franklin Roosevelt the right to get going. And Churchill was relieved. And Japan did not know what was about to hit them.
And I think that one of the great lessons of today and of the war itself is of the power of the individual, of points of light, to coin a phrase, to change history, to change things. We look back sometimes on the past, and for young people here, this is as remote to you as Reconstruction was to President Bush and Senator Dole. That amount of time has passed. So basically, the Civil War was to them what Pearl Harbor is to school children now, which is a remarkable thing. It's one sign of both the length and yet the brevity of American history. But the lesson is that a man with two crewmen in a plane over Chichijima and a man with a squadron near Florence can change history. And it's not all about big impersonal forces. It's not all about some remote clinical drama. It's about people making choices to do the right thing, to pitch in, to think about the other guy. The motto at Andover, where the president went to school, was not for self. That was the lesson. I think there's a direct line between the empathy that President Bush and Senator Dole inculcated and nurtured as young men and the lives of public service they led. They were always able to put themselves in the other guy's shoes. If you're able to put yourself in the other guy's shoes, political compromise becomes more possible.
You know, it's interesting, James, to think about that, because these two men went on to lead their country in very meaningful ways. And think of what they had to go through just to get back on their feet and get going again. It is an interesting combination of selflessness and yet ambition and determination in the same people.
You know, I want to bring it specifically down. We talk about the war and we talk about the veterans, and let's look specifically at what a guy named George Bush was doing. In the Pacific, he had 58 strikes. Now he's flying a 1940s tin can. I get a little upset when I'm up in the air and I get some turbulence in a big jet, right? 58 strikes, 126 carrier landings in the 1940s. Can you imagine with those carriers going up and down 8 to 10 feet? 1,228 hours in the air at the age of 20. And this was dangerous. On Bush's first combat run, he came back and his bunkmate didn't come back. Jim White, George Bush, 20 years old, cried. I'll read you a poem that the Navy carrier pilots would say to each other out in the Pacific. You know, doing what George Bush did wasn't just dangerous. It was the most dangerous operation of World War II, to fly a carrier plane off an aircraft carrier. And these guys joked to each other, gallows humor. He loved his plane, and he loved to fly. He never thought he was going to die. Now, don't feel bad and don't feel blue. Who knows tomorrow? It may be you.
Well, you know, I can't help but reflect thinking about those times and the attitudes that emerged in so many young Americans after the attack on Pearl Harbor. Can anybody imagine someone saying, oh, no, I'm sorry, I feel triggered. I need a safe zone so I can heal.
Well, in fact, the George H.W. Bush version of that was an unsafe zone. His first instinct at Andover was to look into whether he could sign up with the Royal Canadian Air Force, because the Brits didn't care if you were 18 yet. He tried to join early. In later generations, people went to Canada for different reasons. He wanted to go to fight earlier and was prevailed upon to wait until his 18th birthday.
You know, it is sometimes said that when people are asked about subsequent conflicts and different attitudes in the country about them, that, well, World War II was easy because Hitler was so obviously evil. And we were attacked, after all. But it wasn't easy. The feeling in the land was not, prior to that moment, what it quickly became.
Well, the draft, when Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill met at sea off Newfoundland in August of 1941, as James mentioned, they issue the Atlantic Charter, which is a very noble statement of war aims. They get back, and the draft is renewed by the United States Congress by one vote. One vote. At that point, things cooled a bit on the Roosevelt-Churchill side.
Wow.
It was touch and go. That's what history is, and that's what's, I think, important to remember, is there was nothing foreordained about not only our entry into the war, but our victory in the war. And it required statecraft at the highest levels, and it required young men sacrificing their mobility, charging into machine guns.
Yeah, there was a mobilization of a kind that's hard to imagine today, wouldn't you say, James, that what we were able to become as a nation, as a manufacturing superpower, in a matter really of months.
Arsenal of democracy was the goal, and we became that. Rosie the Riveter. I mean, we call it the greatest generation for a reason. It wasn't just the guys and the girls on the front line that did it. It was everybody supporting everything on the home front. In 1942, there was a girls' basketball game in Missouri, and one of the girls lost one bobby pin, and they stopped the game to search for it. This was valuable. You're in the middle of the war, and everybody was in that war, the greatest generation.
25 years ago today, then President George Bush went to Pearl Harbor and spoke with the USS Arizona Memorial in the background. Here is some of what he said.
Back in 1942, June of 42, I remember how Henry Simpson, the Secretary of War, defined the American soldier and how that soldier should be, and I quote, brave without being brutal, self-confident without boasting, being part of an irresistible might without losing faith in individual liberty. The heroes of the harbor engraved that passage on every heart and soul. They fought for a world of peace, not war, where children's dreams speak more loudly than the brashest tyrant's guns. Because of them, this memorial lives to pass its lessons from one generation to the next. Lessons as clear as this Pacific sky. One of Pearl Harbor's lessons is that together we could summon lightness against the dark. That was Dwight Eisenhower. Another, and when it comes to national defense, finishing second means finishing last. World War II also taught us that isolationism is a bankrupt notion. The world does not stop at our water's edge, and perhaps above all, that real peace, the peace that lasts, means the triumph of freedom, not merely the absence of war. Each Memorial Day, not far from this spot, the heroes of Pearl Harbor are honored. Kool-Aid are placed upon each grave by Hawaiian Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts. We must never forget that it is for them, the future, that we must apply the lessons of the past.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very pleased now to welcome to our discussion Rear Admiral DeWolf Miller, known as Chip to his friends. Admiral, please come out and join us. Admiral Miller, among many other things, was captain of the USS George H.W. Bush. He's now serving in the Pentagon. Welcome to you, sir. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
Give us your thoughts on this day.
Well, first off, it's an honor to be here. There's a quote that comes to mind, and it talks something about a nation reveals itself not only through the people that it produces, but through the people that it honors. And so for those of us that currently serve, to be in the presence of 27 World War II veterans, you know, we stand on your shoulders today. We've learned from your lessons, and we're proud to serve. And again, just honored to be here.
Talk a little bit, if you will, about how being the captain, the commander of an aircraft carrier named for former President Bush, what your thinking was as you were doing that, what it meant to you.
Well, there's only one aircraft carrier with a living namesake, and so being on that ship is pretty special. Because of President Bush, Mrs. Bush, the ship's sponsor, Doro, the presence of the Bush family throughout that ship is pretty apparent. Because of that uniqueness, every single sailor that serves on board that ship, no matter what the rank, the day they check on board, we enter them what's called a school ship. And it's about a month-long program where we teach them everything from damage control and how to operate on the ship and what all the bells and whistles mean. But the very first day, they're met by a video given by President Bush welcoming them onto his ship. He expresses his thanks for their service. and the volunteer service that we have now and the fact that they're serving on board this ship. That's pretty special. And so over that month, over the next couple days, we, you know, teach them about President Bush and about World War II. And they learn not only about the man, but they learn about the points of light, about life of service. They learn about literacy, again, through Mrs. Bush and the United Through Reading program, which is very important, where sailors have an opportunity to read to their children. It gets videotaped and then gets sent back home. So for long separations, it's quite meaningful. They learn through Doro about Operation Shower. So when we're away and children are born, they actually have baby showers, things like that. So you get a sense when you check on board that ship that you're joining a family. And at the end of that course, and of course, part of it, you go down to the tribute room, which is a tribute to President Bush. You see letters that he wrote to his mom and dad while he was at flight school. You see that video of him being rescued by the USS Finback, and you learn about all that. At the end of the course, you get your command ball cap, which is pretty special, and you get your patch. And on that patch, it has the ship's motto. And the motto comes from President Bush's inauguration speech in 1989, where he said, "We know what's right, freedom's right. We know what works, freedom works." And so the ship's motto, "Freedom at Work," is emblazoned on every sailor that serves on board that ship.
Wow. Let's talk a little bit now about this moment that we confront today, in which the role of the United States in the world, which was really shaped in the aftermath of World War II, and I think as we all look back on it, we can say that it has been, you know, the American military, the American nation, and the American military in particular, have been kind of a gift to the world in the world we came to know during and after World War II. But today, that role, that purpose, seems once again in question. James, your thoughts?
I'll leave it for the big thinkers. I want to tell a personal story. Please. About President Bush.
Do you know any? Are there any
here? You know, that Pearl Harbor speech you saw, President Bush was president, obviously, and I saw a personal representation of President Bush's attitude towards the enemy. I was honored to be able to accompany President Bush back to Chichijima, where he was shot down. We slept on Iwo Jima, where my father served. We got in a Japanese military helicopter. They circled Mount Suribachi and to give a salute to my father and the boys who served there. We went over to Chichijima, which is right next door to Iwo Jima, and we landed. On that island, President Bush made one of the most beautiful speeches I've ever heard to the populace. We were at a beautiful sushi lunch. He rock and rolled that island. They had never had a personage like this come. And he spoke off the cuff about his forgiveness, about his love of Japan, of his experience with the Japanese. Earlier, the day before, when we got out of that helicopter, I had been to Chichijima before doing research, and I brought Army veterans, Japanese Army veterans, down from the mainland of Japan to meet the president. These were Army veterans who had served on Chichijima, who might have had the order to kill this guy if they fished him out of the water. He got out of the helicopter, and the Japanese Army veterans were here, and President Bush was here, and I said, "Well, President Bush, you were bombing these guys trying to kill them." And I looked at these guys and I said, "If you got your hands on them, you were going to kill them. That's war. What can we say?" And I saw these men hug each other. And over a period of 2 days, tears come to their eyes. And I learned something about that funny thing called war.
Wow. You know, the story of George H.W. Bush is not about remembrance, but about the future. I've never known a man in public life who is so intent on looking forward, on trying to take whatever lessons there are in the past, but always keep moving. One of the many moments in the course of writing the biography in which he wept and then I wept, it was like the world's least effective wasp-on-wasp therapy. You know, we would cry and then we'd change the subject. Was when he talked about Chichijima, as he did with James. And I said, the kind of questions people like me have to ask, which is, what did you learn from nearly dying at the age of 20 and losing Del Delaney and Ted White? And he said that he always wondered, why was I spared? Why was I spared? And I submit that to some extent, his extraordinary pursuit of public service, of familial love, of friendship, of affection, of making a life of service, of making a good life. And it has been headlong. It has been energetic. It has been frenetic. Ask Mrs. Bush how many houses they lived in the last 60 years. I mean, this man moved so fast that once, when he was campaigning against Senator Dole and Ronald Reagan in 1980 in New Hampshire, George Bush shook the hand of a department store mannequin by mistake. Now, Lyndon Johnson would have tried to register that mannequin. So, President Bush is about the future. So is Senator Dole. It's one of the things that's so amazing. George W. Bush, in his acceptance speech in 2000, had a wonderful line that this was the generation that came home and put their medals in a drawer and then built a nation. They built universities, they built interstates, they built businesses. The creation of the American middle class in the 1950s and 60s was one of the great achievements of any society since Rome. And I think that the lesson of these men's lives and the lesson of the world that the veterans here created for us is that we have a solemn obligation to keep moving forward. And free men create free markets. America first is okay as an idea, but let's remember that the last time America first was popular, it was Charles Lindbergh's phrase. And that helped lead to the cataclysm of the Second World War. If we are open, if we are strong, we have always been a nation that, as Colin Powell, President Bush's great national security advisor, once said, America has fought wars, and the only thing we've ever asked for is the land in which to bury our dead.
You know,
can I add to that?
Please.
Can I add something?
Of course.
You know, we're here to remember, and President Bush is famous for looking forward, but this is about war, and it's about the experience of war. My dad fought on Iwo Jima, and when I was 9 years old, my teacher told my class my dad was a hero, and I was proud like only a little boy could be. And that night, I told my dad that my teacher said he was a hero, and my teacher wanted him to speak to my class, and my father said, gee, I'd like to, but I forgot everything. That was always his excuse. And then he said something to me. He said, you know what, James? He said, your teacher said something about heroes, and I'd like you to always remember that the heroes of Iwo Jima are the guys who didn't come back. The first time I interviewed President Bush, about September 2nd, 1944, we went through those rough details of the crash, of how he tried to save his guys, how he's in a burning tin can, and he kept going to the last minute. And we went through the details of that day, and he was seated in a chair. I was in his couch. I was taking notes on a computer. And at the end of the interview, he asked me a question that surprised me. He said, James, in your research, did you come up with any more information about my buddies, Ted White and John Delaney? Well, I was surprised by the question because I thought this would have been resolved in his many runs for office. And I said, no, Mr. President, I'm sorry, I didn't. And at that moment, I saw the look of pain that I've seen on many veterans' faces. And I quickly said, you know, Mr. President, my research says that you did everything you could to save them. Well, to break the silence between us, the tension, he stood up to go back to his desk, and I looked down to close down my computer. The interview was over. And then I looked up when I saw that he didn't return to his desk. He went to the window, and he was standing there, the Texas sun hitting his face. And he looked outside, and he said, you know, I think about those guys all the time.
You
started off by asking a question about the future. So, and in the previous video, President Bush said that isolationism is a bankrupt notion. So you know we've learned those lessons. Our forces are globally deployed. Presence matters. And we get asked about that a lot, and you have the statisticians that go through the stats that go like, you know, two-thirds of the world's population live within 200 miles of the coastline, and 95% of our commercial data and telecoms goes through undersea cables, and so therefore we have to protect our seas. I like to talk about why presence matters and why our Navy and our forces are globally deployed with one example. And it was June 14th, 2014. Again, learning from the lessons of the past. Well, on June 14th, 2014, USS George H.W. Bush and her air wing and accompanying ships were providing air cover over Afghanistan in the morning hours when the polls were opening up, when they were having their very first elections, free elections in Afghanistan. And at that same time, ISIS was starting to make their move out of Syria into Iraq. And so we got a call to say, hey, we need you over here. And I said, okay, we'll get there, but let us make sure that this is done safely, that our troops on the ground and the civilians that are voting can do that under protective cover. We snuck the carrier, started heading a little bit to the west. We recalled all those aircraft. I canceled the follow-on waves that were supposed to be going in to the country. And we said, okay, we know we took care of the most dangerous part. Did a high-speed run through the Strait of Hormuz, and 30 hours later, we had airplanes over Baghdad. Presence matters. If you weren't there, you couldn't have been able to do that. That deterring force, that protective force. So for 54 days, we were the only option, offensive option, that existed in that country. Came from that strike group. And it was because we were there. A couple months later, we ended up having preparing for our very first strikes into Syria. They asked us to put together a coalition. I said, that's easy. We'll get United Arab Emirates, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Bahrain, and Qatar. Because for the last 4 months, we had been operating with those guys because we were there. We knew their pilots, we knew their techniques, we knew them by their first name. We said, here's what we're going to do. And we launched that first strike into Syria, and we continue to operate today. But it wouldn't have happened if we weren't there. So, yes, sir, you're absolutely right. Isolationism is a bankrupt notion. And your forces today have learned from the past.
John.
And it's brilliantly put. Presence matters. And in both the Bush and Dole lives, we have case studies in how friendships and personal diplomacy matter. I remember asking the president what he did when he had any downtime in the White House, which seemed like an oxymoron. But he would say, oh, that was easy. If I had a few minutes, I'd pick up the phone and call an emir in the desert somewhere. And I'd say, hey, emir, how's the weather? And the emir would say, well, I live in a desert. And you say, well, that's great. Hope things get better. And he would hang up. And the point of the calls was that if he ever needed those emirs, if he needed those personal relationships, they would be with him. They were more likely to be with him and the United States because he had been there when he didn't need them. George Bush made friendship into a diplomatic virtue that has shaped the world we live in. There is 35 nations came together after the 2nd of August, 1990, through the middle of January, 1991, when with Bob Dole's leadership, he got a congressional authorization to throw Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait to protect small states from large states, a fundamental lesson of the 1930s, which had led to the Second World War, which is what we're talking about.
Let me just jump in here just briefly, close this out. I was a White House correspondent covering the Bush administration during that time, and I will never forget how President Bush, and with considerable help from Senator Dole, got that war resolution passed and brought a reluctant nation along with him by the sheer force of his conviction and, may I add, by the force of his extemporaneous rhetoric. In instance after instance, the president would come out and he would say just a few words about where matters stood, having made, previous to that, the breathtaking claim that, quote, this will not stand. And I well remember as a reporter thinking, I don't know how he's going to affect that. I mean, here was halfway around the world, the invasion of Kuwait had been a fait accompli, they'd overrun the place, and he had to put together a force to repel that invasion, to reverse that invasion, as well as to get the country and the Congress to support him. And the polling indicated that there was very little support for an entanglement in the Middle East by American forces at the time. But by the time President Bush, with his unwavering determination, and with the help of Senator Dole, who had no easy task trying to get that war resolution passed through the Senate, remember, ladies and gentlemen, that the United Nations authorized that use of force to eject Saddam Hussein's army from Kuwait before the United States Senate acted. And the matter was very much in doubt. Sam Nunn, you may recall, voted no on that, as did a number of others. It was passed, and by the time it passed, and by the time the hostilities began with that bombing campaign that so horrified and enraged Saddam Hussein, the United States people and its Congress was with him. And it has never gotten the credit that I think that act of presidential leadership and congressional leadership deserves, because it went so very well. Such was the leadership of the men that we honor here today. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you found the comments from my colleagues here as insightful and as interesting as I did. We thank them, and we thank you for your attention.